Joining me on the Freedom Pack podcast today, I have Nick Pope. Nick worked for the British government for 21 years at the Ministry of Defence. In the 90s, he ran the British government's UFO project. He's been dubbed as the real-life X-Files. Nick, welcome to the Freedom Pack podcast, my friend.
Thank you. Good to be on.
I guess the first question that comes to mind is, how does somebody end up running the British government UFO program?
You don't ask to join. No, I kind of fell into it almost by accident. I was a civilian employee at the Ministry of Defence, so I had done a number of different postings, and every few years you get moved around, or that was the career structure at the time. And it was just right place, right time. The vacancy on the UFO desk opened up at the exact time I was due for a move. I did know the manager. We had worked together during the first Gulf War. I'd been seconded into the Joint Operations Center as a watchkeeper, and I'd worked for this particular boss before. He was the one with the vacancy. So he said, look, I know that you're looking for a move. I've got a vacancy. How about it? So it just worked out. I think it's the sort of job where they don't want a believer. They probably don't want a skeptic either. In one sense, you want somebody who goes in and takes a data-led approach, not a conclusion-led approach. So probably don't want a skeptic, definitely don't want a believer. They just wanted someone to do that, not as an interest, not as a hobby, but as a government job.
That's really interesting. Whenever I've interviewed anyone on this show, we've had a couple of former CIA spies, we've had British intelligence officers. They all seem to say the same thing as you, that there's this level of serendipity that they end up doing what they do and that they didn't really plan for that career. What level of interest? I know you did. You weren't necessarily a believer. You weren't necessarily a full-time skeptic. But what level of interest did you have in this subject before you fell into that role?
Virtually zero, to be honest. And it goes back. And what you said is very interesting, because it completely resonates with what I've found. Obviously, I have over the years, but particularly recently with developments in the US, met a number of people who have done the whole UFO subject for the US government. And they're exactly the same. They had no particular knowledge or interest in this. It was just they got a tap on the shoulder. Somebody said, look, there's a portfolio opening up, which we'd like you to take on. You get read on to various programs, get the security clearances, and you hear it time and time again. So I'm not surprised that you would say that, and I'm glad that your other interviewees have shared that with you, because it really is the way that this works. But no, I had no real level of interest at all. I mean, probably when I was, I don't know, 12 or 13, like most kids, I'd seen the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Does that count? That's about as far as it goes.
Wow. So to get that tap on the shoulder then, what sort of traits and attributes did you have that you think that the Ministry of Defence would think you would be a good fit for that role?
Almost all of my MOD postings involve me working as an analyst and or as a briefer. And those two things often overlap. And what my skill set was basically being able to take large amounts of complex, sometimes quite technical, sometimes contradictory and frustrating data, and make sense of it, distill it down into very clear briefs for senior people. And I've done that not only on the UFO issue, but on counterterrorism and security issues, finance policy issues, personnel issues. In a sense, the skill of being able to do that doesn't lend itself only to one particular area of business. So, you know, policy, operations, contracts, whatever it might be. If you can do it, you can do it across the board. So I could probably do it with army pensions policy if I had to.
So, when was this program set up initially, and what was the original purpose of it?
Well, the Ministry of Defence and the Royal Air Force had had interaction with UFOs or UAP, as we call them in government, unidentified either aerial or anomalous phenomena. They keep updating the definitions. We'd had some interaction with this from the Second World War onwards, and the so-called Foo Fighters, I mean, the band, I don't, well, the fans probably know, but I'm not sure most other people do, but the band, the Foo Fighters, was named after this Second World War phenomenon of these strange, sometimes balls of light, sometimes objects that tracked or seemed to keep pace with military aircraft, but never actually engaged them in a hostile sense. And after the war, you know, we thought this was maybe some sort of Nazi secret weapon. After the war, it turned out that German and Japanese pilots had seen the same or similar things and had thought that it was some sort of allied secret weapon. So whatever this phenomenon was. So we'd had that, and then we'd had a few other things over the years, but it was 1953 when the Ministry of Defense sort of set up a formal program to look at this. And over the years, it's been embedded in different parts of the organization, sometimes civilian-led, sometimes military-led, sometimes intelligence community-led, sometimes in the Ministry of Defense, sometimes in the Royal Air Force. But essentially, it's done the same thing. It's handled policy on the subject, and it's done the investigations. And so from 53 onwards, we had, and it's, again, it's been called a number of different things. The media tend to call it UFO program, UFO project, UFO desk, just because that's a sort of does what it says on the tin description. In reality, it has extremely unglamorous names like Secretariat Air Staff 2A. It's just civil service jargon that wouldn't mean anything to anyone outside of the system. Hence UFO project and these colloquialisms. We didn't actually call it that, although I did see the other day the MOD used the phrase UFO desk in Parliament. So these terms stick sometimes. But yeah, over the years, we did this job, this work, depending on what was going on at the time. We had somewhere between, you know, a few couple of hundred sightings, and in some years, I think 750, 800 sightings, which we knew was the tip of the iceberg, because a lot of people who see these things don't report because of fear of ridicule and disbelief. And we did our investigations. Most of them we could explain as misidentifications or sensor errors, things like that. And some we couldn't. And that's kind of pretty much where we are.
I'm sure there's a variation of it, but does this program still exist?
It's actually a more complicated question than it sounds. The United States now has a similar program, although at the moment, unlike the job I did, it's not public facing. So it's looking at sightings from military and government and intelligence community personnel and from government contractors, but not from the public. So that's going on in the US, and they call it ARRO, which stands for All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. Yeah, you can tell that it's bureaucrats running this thing. The UK officially, at least, doesn't have a program either, certainly doesn't have a public-facing one. They say that they don't even have an internal one. I have some information from reliable sources to suggest that that might not be entirely correct, shall we say. I mean, it would be inconceivable to me if our pilots obviously are still seeing these things. We see media stories about that from time to time with the commercial pilots, commercial airline pilots anyway. We know that they're being seen by pilots, tracked on radar. The idea that nobody's doing anything with this stretch credulity beyond breaking point. But if there is a program, they're not telling Parliament, they're not telling the media, and they're certainly not telling the public.
Yeah, and I want to preface this question with, obviously, as you've brushed over there, 9 times out of 10, the cases you dealt with could be explained. You could find an explanation. But, you know, maybe 1 in every 10, or I think it's 5% you said that were unexplained. But for those 5% that are unexplained, how serious does the government take the possibility of extraterrestrial craft? Or are they not as interested in that as they are balloons, spy balloons, and craft like that?
It's a very, again, it sounds like a simple question, but it's not, because there's a lot to unpack there. Cool. I mean, obviously, anything, and at one level, anything unidentified in our airspace is a potential defense and national security and indeed flight safety threat. And of course, the default position in government is it's better to assume the worst and be pleasantly surprised when it doesn't come to pass than assume everything's going to be fine, then get caught with your pants down. So the default position is it espionage related? Is it terrorism related? Is it you know, the whole question of drones, of course, and sadly, I'm sure it's only a matter of time before we see a major terror attack involving an aircraft being brought down by a drone with a small explosive device on it, or not even that, just flying into an engine or whatever it is. So that's a big concern. It's still perhaps not as big a concern as it should be. And if anyone's watching those videos out of Ukraine, they should be thinking, well, what's next with this? Where is this tech going to go next? And almost certainly the answer to that is terrorism. So that's one aspect of it. The Chinese spy balloon situation almost a year ago tells us another reason why this is of concern. And we don't necessarily ever articulate this specifically in terms of extraterrestrials. Though obviously with any unknown sighting, all hypotheses are arguably still on the table. So I think the way that we characterized the extraterrestrial hypothesis was we sometimes thought of it as the ultimate low probability, high impact scenario, even if you think it's statistically the least likely of the options compared, for example, to, you know, an experimental spy plane or drone operated by an adversary like China or Russia. Even if the extraterrestrial possibility is much less likely, in a sense, it would be potentially much more impactful, not just at a military level, but at a societal level, depending on what we found. So that's one of the reasons why it is important for government to not eliminate the extraterrestrial hypothesis, even if Occam's razor tells you that that for any given UFO sighting, it's more likely, and this was a soundbite that I used, more likely to be Russian than Martian.
How public facing was this program that you had you were heading up then? If I were a member of the public at the time and I had a pretty compelling sighting of a UFO, maybe I took a video of it or took a picture that couldn't be explained easily, how accessible is this program for me to report an incident to? Or are you only dealing with incidents from official sources, military, things of that nature?
Well, when I was doing the job at the Ministry of Defense, we were very accessible. Indeed, the whole point was we wanted data from the public. And arguably, if we were to solve the UFO mystery, whilst some of our own sightings, pilots and radar operators, may have given us better data in a sort of qualitative sense, it was the public that gave us the quantitative data. I mean, just self-evidently, because, you know, almost 95% more sightings are going to involve the public. And so to give the example, if before our program had been formally terminated, you had seen a sighting, you would literally phone up the operator, say, please give me the number for the Ministry of Defence headquarters in London. You would have gotten through to the switchboard. You would have been asked what the nature of your business was. And you would say, I'd like to report a UFO sighting. And someone would have said, certainly, sir, I'll just put you through. And the phone on my desk would have rung. And you would have been speaking to me, or if I wasn't at my desk, one of the admin staff, and you would relay your report, and then we would investigate it. So we were very public facing, and indeed, if you go to the National Archives, I actually came back out of early retirement to help with this, declassified around about 60,000 pages of documents relating to all this, many of which I wrote, but and they're all there at the National Archives. So yeah, we did do some classified work, but most of what we did was unclassified, and most of what we did involved the public reporting their sightings and us investigating them.
Wow, it's fascinating that there's no real alternative to that today. It does seem like such a valuable tool, but I guess with the rise in believers, with the rise of conspiracy theories, I bet that phone line would be jammed non-stop these days.
It was, and that was one of the reasons why we pulled the plug, because we were getting inundated with Chinese lantern reports, and frankly, we were getting inundated with crazies.
Yeah. On those 5% of cases that you couldn't be explained, if one of those cases, say, were to turn out to be confirmed, or at least highly suspicious to be extraterrestrial, in your honest opinion now, what chance would you say of the British government going public with that information?
It depends on the scenario and whether or not they could keep it secret. I mean, it's possible to imagine a number of scenarios where there would be something so sort of major that, I mean, you know, I hate to say it, but sort of almost landing on the Mall in front of Buckingham Palace or something like that. But if it's, let's just take that off the table and suppose that it's data that at first the government, and the government only has. I think it depends. The problem with embedding UFO programs in the Ministry of Defense or in the military, as most countries around the world who have a UFO program do, is that you're embedding them in inherently secretive organizations where the default position is not necessarily to tell the people straight away. And I think before we told the people, we'd want to make sure we want the answers or good estimates, assessments of some fairly basic questions. Like, you know, what are we dealing with? Is the big one, of course, is there a potential threat? Is it friendly? Is it hostile or is it neutral? Is it biological or is it post-biological, i.e. AI? Could we derive any technology from a better understanding of this? Now, that's a big question, which feeds into the secrecy question that you asked, because we wouldn't, if we acquired something, whether it's data or even, you know, hardware, we wouldn't necessarily want to tell everyone, because frankly, the nation on earth that first acquires and figures this out is going to be the dominant force politically, militarily, and economically for the foreseeable future. And we'd like that for ourselves. And what we, flipping it, we definitely would not want an adversary figuring it out first. So I think the technology aspects of this are a very strong incentive for government not to go public with this, at least in the first instance. So I think at the very least, unless it was, as I say, this major thing that you couldn't hide, you'd want a sort of period of exclusivity where you had a long, hard think about this. What do we think we're dealing with? What are the threats and opportunities? What, frankly, convince us, and this would be an internal discussion, Cabinet Office, Number 10, Ministry of Defense, it would be, well, convince us what the benefits would be of telling people.
What do you think of this idea then that this theory that seems popularized online? I think it came after a couple of the US government announcements around UFO programs and things. And this idea started to circulate that that the public were being sort of drip-fed information to the point that when they release further information, like projects or any future sightings, that it wouldn't spark such a massive reaction. Is there any credibility to that theory, in your opinion?
Yes, I do think that it's got some attractive points to it. And you could say that, since for the last 6, 7 years, certainly in the United States, which is the center of gravity for this topic at the moment, if you were to design some sort of acclimatization program to drip feed this out to people, because when you make the big announcement or when the big reveal happens, however it unfolds, you don't shock people by telling them something that they already believe. Now, if you were going to design a program to do just that, it would look like what's happened. You would have NASA, after years of saying they're not interested, do a study. You would have the Pentagon release some videos. You would have the pilots and the radar operators talk about how they chase these things and track these things. You'd have the intelligence community personnel come and say they ran those programs. You would have hearings in Congress. And this is exactly what's going on right now in the US. So an acclimatization program would look exactly like what we're living right at this moment. And people with some knowledge of these programs say that's exactly what's happening. They talk about a controlled disclosure plan. Controlled because you don't want an adversary getting the technology, as I mentioned. You don't also want some sort of lone maverick getting the technology, because almost any extraterrestrial spacecraft that you could envisage to manage viable interstellar travel would involve the generation of very large amounts of energy. And almost anything that involves generating huge amounts of energy can be weaponized. So another reason why you wouldn't want to just dump all that information out into the public domain, particularly if you didn't yet fully understand it yourself. So that's one thing. Another reason why you want a controlled disclosure plan is we have, my goodness, we have enough political, and let's not kid ourselves, religious differences are at the heart of a lot of it. Instability in the world today and hatreds caused by that. If you throw extraterrestrials into the already kind of pretty tinderbox situation, I mean, you can imagine worst case scenario what would happen. Because if you attack or undermine or challenge fundamentally somebody's beliefs, and so it's a major question. What will the leaders of the major world religions make of this? What will the most fundamentalist practitioners, whichever religion they adhere to, what will the more fundamentalist extremists, what will they make against this? Will they push back against it? Will they push back violently? Will it, what further instability will we see? So it needs to be carefully managed. And the alternative, and I've heard a few people use this phrase, again, insiders I'm talking about, if this doesn't get done in a sort of drip feed, step by step, controlled way, the alternative is what's called catastrophic disclosure. And catastrophic disclosure is, for example, if an adversary, knowing that maybe some of these instabilities are going to hit the US and the UK maybe harder because, ironically, because we're more democratic, an adversary might just, if they're able to do so, unleash catastrophic disclosure on the world for geopolitical reasons.
That I want to get to these topics before we wind down towards the end of this conversation. I want to talk about the sort of Pandora's box that comes with the politics, the religion. But before we get there, just to circle back to your career, I find in the world of UFO sightings and stories, I find the most compelling stories to be those that are that come from military or some sort of official. And I think you dubbed was it the Cosford incident? You dubbed it the most compelling case of your career. Why was it the most compelling case of your career?
I think for a number of reasons. Firstly, it wasn't just a flash and then it's gone. This was a wave of sightings that took place over a series of period of about, I think, 8 hours. No, pardon me, six hours, approximately 6 hours. Secondly, it involved multiple different locations all around the UK, but many of the witnesses were police and military personnel, and in particular, two Air Force bases in the Midlands, Cosford and Shawbury. Cosford, for some reason, got to name this incident. I think I'd be a little annoyed if I was Shawbury, because actually the Shawbury sighting was a little bit more spectacular, but Cosford had more witnesses. So, and thinking back, I think I was probably the one that named it, so maybe I slipped up there. So apologies, everyone at RAF Shawbury. But lots of the reports involved huge triangular shaped craft, which seemed to be capable of moving from a very slow speed or a hover to very high Mach speeds in an instant with no sonic boom, which again is it's one of what Lou Elizondo, who is a US intelligence officer, who's investigated UAP. He's dubbed this one of the five observables, this rapid acceleration with no sonic boom. And we saw that in the Cosford incident long before the term the five observables was coined. So we had that. We had a patrol of Royal Air Force police officers saw it at RAF Cosford. The meteorological officer saw it at RAF Shawbury. He saw a narrow beam of light come down at the ground, tracking backwards and forwards. He heard an unpleasant low frequency humming sound that he said he could feel reverberating through his body as well as hear it. I've heard that from some of the other witnesses. And this was, I mean, when I talked to this last witness that I'm talking about, he said to me the following morning when I interviewed him, he said, "Nick, I've been in the Air Force 8 years. I, you know, see and hear fast jets, attack helicopters, whatever, almost every day. It's kind of like my job." He said, "I've never seen anything like this before in my life," and it clearly unnerved him and unnerved a number of the other police and military witnesses. And there's a declassified file on it at the National Archives, which I opened, and so people can follow some of the story in there. And there've been a couple of TV documentaries about it. Really, really interesting case. And of course, there's not much middle ground with a sighting like that. We found a cluster of sightings at about 1:10 in the morning, were attributable to the re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere of a Russian rocket. There was one other really spooky thing about this case, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it at first. I realized that at the back of my mind while I was doing the investigation, I thought there's something odd about the date. Something, I couldn't quite figure it. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, after the investigation had wound down, after the diplomatic aspects of this had wound down, because we'd been talking to the US government about this, firstly to check that they weren't testing some sort of prototype aircraft, but secondly because they were having sightings of their own, and they were asking us about our sightings. But when everything wound down, I realized what it was, and it was the fact that these sightings happened late on March 30th and in the early hours of March 31st, 1993. Well, on that exact same night, 3 years earlier, a very similar UFO had entered Belgian airspace, had been tracked on Belgian national radar and on the NATO integrated radar network. The Belgians had actually scrambled two F-16 fighters to intercept this craft. They'd locked onto it with their airborne radars. And yeah, as I say, it was only a little later that I realized, wow, it's the exact same night of the year, but 3 years on. What did that mean? We didn't know, but it was interesting. In all my defense career, I was taught, don't believe in coincidences. Look for those join the dots.
Yes, it's an unbelievably compelling case. So all these years later now, what is the best guess for what was going on there? Or were you just unable to really come to any sort of assumption?
Really unknown. I mean, it's like it's kind of like a it's a binary thing, like a crime in a police file. It's either solved or it's not. If it's solved, it resolves itself into one of a number of different things: aircraft lights, weather balloons, meteors, satellites, Chinese lanterns, hoax, psychological delusion, sensor error, whatever it might be. But if it's unknown, it's unknown. Might it be extraterrestrial? Yeah, it might. But we can't prove that. We don't have a definitive smoking gun. I know conspiracy theorists say that we're hiding these things in an Air Force hangar somewhere. If they are, I suspect that's in the United States, and that they didn't tell us Brits. But no, unknown means unknown. Yeah, you can apply Occam's razor and say, again, sure, it's more likely that it was a secret prototype aircraft, or drone than an extraterrestrial spacecraft, but we don't know that. And we obviously did check very carefully. Even if you're not read into a specific black project, we know what we've got. And somebody can have a quiet word and say, look, can't read you into the program, but no need to, look into that one, look the other way, old chap. And of course, you would. And you could say, well, but not if it's Russian or Chinese. But again, and I can't go into too much details, but obviously through our intelligence operations, we've got a pretty good idea of what any adversary has, what the cutting edge of their technology is in terms of aerospace, for example.
Now, another one of the biggest UFO phenomena stories out there when it comes to the UK is the Rendlesham Forest incident. So this is a series of reported sightings of unexplained lights near the Rendlesham Forest in Suffolk. I think that was in the 80s, right?
1980, yes, December 1980.
So tell us about that. What made that so significant? Or why is that story so famous now? What was so compelling about that case?
Well, I think the fact that it's almost a perfect storm of a UFO case, almost everything that you would want came together in this one series of incidents. Firstly, it wasn't just an isolated sighting. It took place over a series of 3 days and involved multiple witnesses. Also, a lot of those witnesses were military personnel. Rendlesham Forest lies between RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge in Suffolk, And despite the prefix, these were US Air Force bases on British soil, part of the wider US presence in Europe. The witnesses included the deputy base commander, so probably one of the most senior ranking individuals to have seen a UFO whilst on duty and reported it. Also, the fact that there was physical trace evidence. The UFO was briefly tracked on radar, both British radar systems and US Air Force radar systems. And this wasn't just lights in the sky. On the first of the three nights, it was alleged that a small craft probe device of some sort landed briefly in Rendlesham Forest and then took off again vertically. But the important point about the fact that it landed is that the landing site could then be forensicated, which it was. And so we had soil samples. We had samples of the trees. This came down in a clearing, and I mean, not only were there three indentations in the hard frozen ground where and fresh ones, so it could be shown that an object weighing several tons had indeed come down in this small clearing, but also that this was in a clearing, as I mentioned, and the sides of the trees facing the clearing were burnt and scorched. And so there were samples, of the tree bark and the sap, samples from the soil, control samples from the same general area, but outside of the immediate vicinity. And most importantly of all, they took a Geiger counter there and found, and again, this is not disputed because it's recorded in the Ministry of Defence file, which has now been declassified and released. It says that the levels of radioactivity seemed, and it's an exact quote, significantly higher than the average background levels, unquote. So, and as I say, that's in the official government file on this. So that's just one of a number of reasons why this is such a compelling case. And some of the witnesses later claimed that they had some health issues in later life, which they attributed to this. The Veterans Administration in the US refused to pay out because they said how can we pay out on a UFO incident? And then a declassified British intelligence assessment, which I knew about, which used the phrase UAP radiation in specific reference to these Rendlesham Forest witnesses. And I knew that there was a lawyer doing some pro bono work for some of the Rendlesham witnesses who had been told they couldn't even get their medical records because they'd been classified for some reason, which, and they went to their senators, and their senators, they were going, "That's crazy. That doesn't make sense. We've never seen this before. What's going on?" Well, I managed to get this declassified intelligence assessment. I gave it to the lawyer. I said, "Look, just look at Volume 3, Annex 6, page, whatever it is." And there it was in black and white. I was amazed they declassified it. I mean, I wouldn't have said so otherwise, of course, because of the Official Secrets Act, but they declassified it. So I said, "Look," I said, "there's the quote." And it said something like, "The well-reported Rendlesham incident is a case where it might be suggested that witnesses got closer to UAP radiation for longer time periods than normal." Well, I gave that to the lawyer. The lawyer gave it to the senators and to the VA, and they settled the case.
Wow.
So, I mean, I teamed up afterwards. I teamed up with two of the U.S. Air Force witnesses, John Burroughs and Jim Penniston. We wrote a book on the case called Encounter in Rendlesham Forest. 100,000 words just on this one case. It's the only UFO book in history that has ever had to have gotten the security clearance of the manuscript from both the US and the UK government.
Wow, man, you have sold me on that book, if anyone has ever sold me on a book. Wow. There's so much, Nick, there's so many questions I have here. And the definition of a good podcast for me is when I'm coming out of it with more questions than I had going into it. And that's where I am right now. I hope I get to speak to you many times more. But before we go, there's a couple of more questions I'd love to ask you. And I wish I could delve deeper into these questions I've already asked you, but with time against us, I'd like to move on here and ask you. This is a question I'm fascinated by because this is a very polarizing figure in the world of UFOs. And again, I'm neither a believer nor a skeptic. There's that quote that, the skeptic has to be right every single time, the believer has to be right once. I don't particularly want to put myself in either of those situations. And this is a very polarizing figure, and I'm fascinated by him because one, it's either a very interesting account of just an absolutely crazy story, or it's a very interesting case of human psychology and how far one person will go to try and make you believe something. And I'm talking about Bob Lazar. I read his book a month ago, Dreamland. Very, very interesting book for both of those reasons I said there. Now, I haven't drawn a conclusion on this guy. He's either got the craziest story of all time, or he's a very, very detailed and committed liar. What is your honest opinion of Bob Lazar?
Well, before I answer that, I should say there's a third alternative. And the third alternative is that he's, and I suppose you could say, a willing or unwilling part of a disinformation campaign or an intelligence operation to plant a particular narrative into the public domain for whatever reason. So
Yes.
as ever, whenever you're looking at anything that involves the intelligence community, and there is no getting away from the fact that the UFO issue and the intelligence community have been inextricably linked for decades. So yeah, anything involving the intelligence community is always going to be, what's the quote, a wilderness of mirrors. And so I don't know. There's an old joke in the intelligence analyst community, interesting if true. That's kind of your default assessment when you hit something like that. Parts of the story do seem to be true. He does seem to have worked at Area 51 for a while. As for all the rest of it, I don't know. What I will say is that more modern, more recent whistleblowers like David Grush have come out with claims that would certainly seem to corroborate some of what Bob Lazar says. And the good news with all this is that in the United States Congress right now, there are a number of people on both sides of the political divide, and that's quite refreshing in these divided times, Republicans and Democrats coming together in Congress to investigate David Grush's claims, to investigate what the government does or doesn't know about UFOs more generally. And so if Bob Lazar's story is true, or whether or not it's true, that might be something that this current congressional investigation, or rather multiple investigations into David Grush's claims, might help us go back, circle back on Bob Lazar's claims and figure out whether any of that's true.
All of the conspiracy and ideas around Area 51, do you think, as a member of the British Military of Defence, heading up a program like you headed, if Area 51 was being used as a place to try and back engineer alien craft, do you think you would have been privy to any of that information if such thing was going on?
I don't know. It's, I like to think so because I had a very high security clearance and need to know, but I'm also not arrogant enough to suggest that it could never happen, because time and time again in my Ministry of Defence career, just when you thought you knew everything about a subject, there was someone in a little basement office somewhere who was read onto a program that you weren't read onto. So never say never. I think I would have known, but I can't guarantee it. So, and of course, it may be, I mentioned this idea that if anyone has figured any of this out, it's probably the United States. And maybe the United States just on this didn't tell the UK, because it goes back to the point about not wanting to disclose straight away. And you might think, well, but you'd tell your friends. Well, not if you are worried that your friends are penetrated by foreign intelligence agencies. Generally speaking, in intelligence work, the more people you tell, the more likely it is your secret will get out inadvertently. So yeah, it's nice to tell your friends, but there have been times, of course, when the US looked at the UK and thought, well, they had the Cambridge spy ring. And then there've been times when we've looked at the US and we've said, well, they've had, kind of people in the CIA and in the FBI who turned out to be spying for the Soviets. So the safest thing is not to tell even your friends.
Now, you're open about exploring possibilities. You, like you say, you don't really have a foot in one camp or another. You're not trying to push any sort of narrative. You are just open to having conversations. How far does that go? To what extent does that go? Are you the type of person that'll explore any of these conversations, or there's certain theories and certain conspiracy theories that you won't go anywhere near even entertaining the idea of? I'm thinking of things like Project Bluebeam or the idea of ancient alien craft being used by modern governments. Do you explore those topics at all, or are they topics you just say, no, thank you?
I don't mind speculating about almost anything. And I think it's very healthy to ask questions, to push boundaries, not to accept the official narrative on any particular subject, and to, ask some critical questions. Just as long as you differentiate between what you know and what you think. So, for example, I have created and host a TV series called After Contact, and it looks at the societal impact of disclosure and first contact. And there's two seasons of six episodes each. Each episode is a deep dive into a particular aspect of society: politics, religion, science, technology, the media, the economy, language, whatever it might be. And for each of those episodes, I found an expert, a journalist, an economist, a neuroscientist, a linguist, whatever it was. And we had some fun with it. It was informed speculation, but it was speculation. But we didn't mind doing it, as long as we didn't present it to the viewers as this is a proven fact, because it's not. But that's part of the creative process, and that's part of maybe a good contingency plan. You think through all the possibilities. So I, when it comes to, you mentioned ancient astronaut theory, the idea that we've been visited in our distant past, our ancestors misperceived these extraterrestrial visitors as gods, and then constructed great monuments and structures in honor and commemoration of that. Is it possible? Yeah, why not? Can I prove it? No, of course not. So I think I don't mind speculating, but like I say, I think it's important that we don't say something is proven when it isn't, and we make it very clear. And I certainly do, for example, in a TV series like After Contact, when I transition from things that we know to things that might come to pass. But I think it is important to think. We get so hung up with a sort of skeptic versus believer dogfight about UFOs, we forget to ask the important questions like, well, look, if it is true, if it does happen, what happens next? Earlier in the show, we talked about religious kind of belief and hatreds and instabilities and what might happen if you suddenly threw extraterrestrials into the mix. It would be like a grenade going off. And so the societal impact of first contact or disclosure, however it unfolds, is interesting and important.
The last two questions I want to ask you before I ask you our sign-off question. These are questions when I mentioned you were coming on the show, there were so many topics thrown at us by our listeners of what they would like us to ask you. There were two that kept cropping up, so I'll ask you the two. What do you make of conspiracy theories like, I think it's called Project Bluebeam, this idea that alien sightings are and UFO phenomenon are dropped in by the government on purpose to try and sort of hold control over the public?
Yeah, I don't rule it out. And I mean, at its extreme end, Project Bluebeam postulates that it might be possible with a mix of holographic projection technology, Hollywood special effects, and government information psyops, it might be possible to do anything like create the second coming, or create, and this is where it ties into this subject, a sort of false flag alien invasion, that you could then bring in something like a space version of the Patriot Act and take away even more freedoms. And I think, I don't know that I quite believe it, but I think that anyone who remembers how many of our individual freedoms were taken away during the COVID pandemic should think about this long and hard and say, if the government can do that to you, for a respiratory disease, which was hardly a new or unexpected thing. We had government contingency plans for this for years, and we've seen it before. And yet we were there, we all were under house arrest, effectively mandated to be masked and jabbed, and you know, things which we now know had statistically insignificant healthcare benefits. But you know, at the time, there was a real visceral fear which was being actively promoted by the government. They were in a situation where the statistics, the data showed that unless you were sort of 80 plus immunocompromised and obese, you were unlikely to have a really bad outcome. And yet that's not the narrative that was pushed. And yet, I know I'm going off topic, but this is important, and it's directly relevant to this. And you would find yourself either deplatformed or shadow banned from social media for even saying things like, Sweden seems to be doing quite well, and they haven't done, you know, it's like, no, you can't say that. So if anyone thinks this doesn't read across to UFOs, I think they're kidding themselves. It does. And people, you're right to ask that question. And the people that have sent in that question about could it be about control should look, I think, back at what was done to us during COVID and say, yeah, actually, how would that play out in relation to extraterrestrials?
Yes. And nothing that I've said, but as through guests, I'm certainly aware of the misinformation rules on YouTube, I can tell you that. So you're saying that in these uncertain times and these times in which people are questioning why the government make the decisions that they do, you gave the example of COVID, but I, you know, it goes further than that when you have these conversations around government control. You think that just adds fuel to the fire when considering the idea that a government would be capable of faking an alien invasion to assume even further control over the population?
Yeah, I'm not sure you could fake I don't think the technology is there yet. I'm not sure you could fake an alien invasion. But if you were so minded to do, you could put into the public and media arena a narrative about UAP in our airspace, interacting with our nuclear facilities, getting dangerously close to our aircraft carriers, our missile silos, our fast jets. And that narrative is exactly what is unfolding. Now, maybe, of course, that narrative is true. And of course, the pilots, they say, no, this is exactly what's happening. But I just to throw out counter possibilities, I am saying it is possible that a lot, some of this, I don't know necessarily all, but some of it could be an intelligence operation to somehow talk up an extraterrestrial possibility for some reason.
Yeah,
Maybe
I
to
mean,
distract us. I mean, we on a limited basis, we did see this back in the 50s and the 60s, where the CIA and the US Air Force found it more helpful for people to talk about flying saucers than speculate that they'd just seen a U-2 or an SR-71. So they kind of talked up the flying saucer narrative. Maybe this is a modern version of that. I think it's gone a little too far for that, but there is a comparison to be drawn with historical precedent.
it certainly makes sense to me, and I see where people come from in the idea that, if I think there's a possibility of extraterrestrials visiting this planet, I'm suddenly going to care a lot less about what my government are doing in a country on the other side of the world or what shady business they might be up to. I'm thinking, please, government, just save me from, the unknown here. So I do understand where people are coming from there. And I do think those theories are worth exploring. The last one I'll ask you before I let you go. We've talked about a couple of theories there that I and yourself think, yeah, they're worth exploring. But I wonder what you'll think of this one. There are some theories and some stories that I just look at and I think, I don't even know if I can take this one seriously. It's this. Do you remember when the Mexican alien
Yes.
footage came out? I remember hearing about it on Twitter, and I thought, "Wow, this is going to be blockbuster news." And I headed on, and I found the video. And as soon as I saw that video, I just couldn't help but laugh at what looked to me like paper mache, I'll be honest. What were your original thoughts when you saw that video come out?
Yeah, I think with something like this, it's sometimes it's a little bit too good to be true. It's like, come on. And yeah, I don't think it was helpful. And actually, interesting that you asked that question. Part two of that whole situation is unfolding, I think, almost literally today. I think that the same people behind that event in Mexico are, I believe, literally today in Los Angeles, unveiling either some new mummies or some new findings or both. But look, my response to this is very simple. Write it up as a scientific paper, get it peer reviewed, get it published in Science and Nature. And there's no reason not to do that. In fact, there's every reason to do that because the person that does that, if it turns out to be true, will not only win themselves the Nobel Prize, but they will get to write their name in history. So when that doesn't happen, when you just have what looks like a PR stunt, you have to ask yourself, well, why is that? So I never say never, but it's like, well, let's see it in Science or Nature first. And I my wife's a physical anthropologist. She studies bones. She has taught a course on mummies. Convince someone like her. Don't just don't invite the media and do a sort of show and tell.
Well put, sir. I want to be appreciative of your time, so thank you so much for joining me today. This hour has flown by. I feel like I talked to you for 3, 4 hours. But for everyone listening and watching right now, they may be thinking, I want more from Nick. I want to check out his books. I want to follow him on Twitter. I want to look at his website. Where can we direct everyone to right now to find more from you?
My website is nickpope.net, and the social media platform I use most is X, formerly known as Twitter, where my handle, if that's what it's now called, if it ever was, is at Nick Pope MOD. MOD, of course, being Ministry of Defense, but at Nick Pope MOD. And I
Amazing.
try and keep that updated with all my latest news and views.
Amazing. So that is at Nick Pope MOD. I will make sure to link that in the description below. Yes, it's very hard when you type your name in on Twitter. The first thing, you share your name with a very famous goalkeeper in the world of football, unfortunately.
Well, you know, it's the funny thing. I think I've had questions come to me like, you know, if you're facing a penalty, do you kind of tend to go to the left or the right? Do you commit yourself? And he's had questions like, well, I was walking my dog last Tuesday night and I saw this strange light in the sky.
Yes. So I'll make sure that's linked in the description below so no one gets confused with the Newcastle United goalkeeper.
Well, and I should say, yeah, of course, he's I've followed his career with interest once
yeah.
that started being an issue. And of course, it's very, very sad that he picked up an injury this season.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that he'll get fit and back into the side soon. And who knows, push to get an England place back.
Yeah,
We'll see.
absolutely.
We'll see.
Absolutely. Well, I'll make sure all your information is linked in the description below. Until then, till next time, Nick, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. This hour has flown by. I hope we get to do another one of these in the future, my friend.
Thank you. I've enjoyed our conversation.